there are variations among different groups. And today's speaker, Professor Vesperi, was skilled in the art of storytelling. She was, in fact, a reporter. Before joining the New College faculty, she was a member of the editorial board and a staff writer and a columnist at the St. Petersburg Times, one of the really good newspapers in the United States. She is the author of the book City of Green Benches, Growing Old in a New Downtown. So in preparation for her talk today, I bought the book and read it. It's really interesting. St. Petersburg in the 60s had a bunch of green benches in the streets in downtown St. Petersburg. People sat on the benches during the day and talked to each other and watched the passersby, and it was a great kind of community site. The only problem developed was when photos of these benches went out over the wire, and people across the country saw a bunch of old people sitting around in downtown St. Petersburg. So the city thought this was not good publicity. And so city council determined to get rid of the benches. And in Maria's book, she has two photos, one of the before with all of these benches and hundreds of folks sitting there enjoying the day, communicating with each other. And the second photo is of empty streets, nobody. So it's an interesting book, but I'm going to pass the microphone on to her now. So please join me in welcoming Professor Maria Vesperi.
Thank you, Don. That was a lovely introduction and a really accurate description of what anthropology is, too. You know, the literal translation of anthropology from the Greek is the study of man. And when I was in college, that's what we were told it was. Now, for obvious reasons, it's called the study of people or the study of humanity. But it is really the study of man. And if you look at the history of anthropology, which I teach, it's really only in the mid-20th century and on that there was any focus on women at all. It was all about men. So that's just a little aside. About that, it's kind of interesting. What I'd like to talk to you about today is I'm actually going to read something rather than just talk extemporaneously. This is an adaptation of a presentation I gave in late August at the University of Copenhagen. My husband and I were invited to lecture there in a life course graduate seminar. And this is a new study, you know, study of the life course. It's not just aging or children. It's trying to look at the entire lifespan. One of my specialties has been aging. That's how I came to Florida as a young person, and I'm still here today, many years later. But I guess my combination of my interest in journalism and in anthropology, I've always paid attention to media representations of aging. And I also study symbolic theory, so I'm interested in the symbolism of a picture or an image. So I'm going to start out with these slides. These are cartoons. I'll take a peek at them, and we'll come back to them at the end if we have time. This first one is called Old Age Crashes In. And you can see, they're very political. They're not very flattering either. This one is called What is Retirement? All right, that's a commentary on people staying in the workforce. This one's called Maladies of the Next Millennium. Okay, get that one. this next image is for sale by an advertising group, so you can buy this image and use it in your ad. And I think that's, it has no title, I think it's kind of interesting. gives a certain message, right? This one is called Social Security. And this is when cartoons work, they speak on several levels. So you've got global warming, you've got the shrinking of Social Security, you've got the two generations, and then you've got the bird who's kind of, yeah. This one's called Not So Happy New Year. Like one of the others, a commentary on how older people are not making way for the young, you know, in the workforce and so on. All right. This one's called A Brief History of Boomer Political Involvement. There are a lot of unflattering comments about baby boomers, and that's the group I'm going to be talking about in my comments. This one from The New Yorker. And it has a caption in the cartoon that says, need more roughage. And then this last one from a Pew Research Center study. It says, baby boomers approach age 65 glumly. So you kind of get the idea, right? Some of the political commentary. And what I want to say in this presentation is to talk about how entertainment and news media reflect public policy and marketing in ways that shift that influence the shifting boundaries of the life course category old age. In other words, who's considered old and who isn't, as increasing numbers of baby boomers join the demographic group. During the last decades of the 20th century, there was a decreased attention to aging as a social welfare issue in the United States and a correlating emphasis on healthy, active seniors with strong stock portfolios, independent lifestyles, and marketplace clout. Affluent and middle-class retirees were increasingly identified with aspirational models of late life based on private entitlement, less social welfare, more private pension savings, and freedom from civic ties. News coverage of aging became more inclusive across generations and less focused on poverty and age-identified health problems, with increased attention to wellness, consumer choice in retirement, and personally fulfilling second careers. If you remember, there was a lot of news coverage of this. Before the 2008 economic downturn, marketing experts predicted that future discretionary spending would be controlled by older, healthier, more demanding consumers who were sensitive to stereotypes and prepared to resist them. Negative portrayals of aging in advertising reportedly declined, as images of older people were decoupled from stereotypical settings and products, suggesting that changing cultural values were combining with the spending power and sheer numbers of baby boomers to force a gradual but profound retreat from conventional, largely negative expectations about social and physical aging. In the United States, at least, the economic forecast has changed slightly. There are many reasons for concern, but to adapt an old saying, where some see problems, others see opportunity. This is certainly true from a researcher's point of view, as today's economic climate provides an excellent opportunity to explore how closely popular representation of age, as disseminated through mass media, are linked to ideas about whether older people are assets or burdens, resources or deficits. It will be important to see whether elders experience new levels of media stereotyping and disenfranchisement as the healthy, wealthy image of just a decade ago is supplanted by more realistic models of aging that do include extended years in the workforce, reduced retirement incomes, and increasing healthcare costs. And you can see that all of these cartoons address that, and they did stereotype and did bring a pretty negative view. These are all current cartoons that I collected back in August. Does old age mean anything in its own terms? From a cultural anthropologist's perspective, age is in some measures a constructed category, hence malleable and much less stable than it appears at a given moment. It cannot be grasped head on. To appreciate its contours, one must catch its reflection in social interactions, customs, policies, and an ever-shifting range of symbolic representations. Mass marketing is a great source for this research. For example, in the United States, one can document how the cultural construction of old age as a space and time of deficit, reduction, and loss has been reflected in traditional efforts to shape the consumption patterns of older people. In a case such as this, advertisers draw transparently on claims to restore, replace, or retain youthful attributes, or conversely, to mask, suppress, or erase evidence of the aging process. Such marketing locates desire in a kind of temporal regression, often symbolized by dehistoricized montages of imagery and music. You've probably seen these commercials where people go back in time, you know, and they're always for some age-restoring product. In U.S. popular culture, positive images of the aging body are rarely represented as natural in the here and now. In other words, you don't see people the age they are. That's not considered the natural look. Instead, past becomes present through the restorative powers of prescription medications that enable elders to stick around for a mother-daughter mall fest or a multi-generational stroll on the beach. The marketing of drugs for high blood pressure is particularly ubiquitous in this regard. And you've all seen these commercials where the person takes the medication and in the next scene they're strolling on the beach with the grandchildren, right? Here the focus is on function, safety, and control. Until very recently, increasing numbers of marketing experts predicted that future discretionary spending would be controlled by older, more demanding consumers who are already sensitive to stereotypes and prepared to resist them. At the same time, advertisers began to see age-related topics as unstable, even dangerous ground. They wondered, where is the balance between exploiting age biases that promote youth, making retinol and hair dye and even Viagra oh so easy to sell, while not offending an aging population that did not want to be considered old? Here, for instance, is an excerpt from a July 2011 blog post on the marketing site Engage Boomers. And you can look this up on the internet. It's a site called Engage Boomers. It's all about selling. And here's the quote. Across the board, marketers have effectively ignored boomers who have tons of money in favor of trendy teens and post-adolescents, many of whom can't find a well-paying job to support their credit card addiction. Simple common sense dictates that marketers should turn their thinking around. Yet they seem to have little or no interest in learning how to sell to those boomers. Too bad, because in some ways, boomers are even more self-indulgent than their kids and grandkids. And they're eager to spend on themselves before eventually passing whatever's left to the next generation. And further, a marketing prediction from this blogger, whose name is Vincent Vassallo, tolerance of ageism will begin to end with the advent of the baby boomers, a huge, rich, and powerful group of individuals who won't sit still for being treated as anything less than the center of their own little universe. As they enter old age, and that's in quotes, they're going to mark that milestone in ways that will force us to transform how we treat older adults, and ultimately that will be good for business and society. So this is your raw marketer's view of aging and how to get in there and sell something. This caution has been reflected in efforts by advertisers and feature writers to facilitate or even celebrate age-related transitions, such as the movement of the baby boomers from midlife to retirement. Interestingly, however, these new rites of passage images were not inscribed on the body. Instead, some advertisers began to relocate the aging body to an imagined future, where the locus of desire could be transferred from persons to personal purchasing power. In one frequently broadcast financial advertisement, a fulfilled lifetime flashed in a montage of images before the eyes of a carefully groomed gray-haired man with the right credit card in his wallet. The message was, wise investments today yield a beach house tomorrow. And you've already always seen that ad. I think it's from American Express. Journalists, too, focus largely on boomers as major consumers of housing, healthcare, and leisure services. Newspapers offered extensive feature articles on retirees as nesters, following couples who are always healthy and almost always heterosexual as they spent discretionary retirement income on fixing up the house or furnishing a vacation home. And there are just lots of ads, you've seen them. To some extent, this is still the case. Consider this from the website of Mary Furlong & Associates, a marketing and public relations firm that specializes in services that are, quote, uniquely geared to drive new opportunities for clients in the baby boomer and senior market-wise investments. Okay, the headline of this on this site is, "This bubble won't burst." And then it explains, "You can tap into one of the world's largest and fastest growing markets by reaching out to baby boomers and senior consumers. In the United States alone, there are more than 108 million people over age 45 as of 2006, a group with more than $2 trillion in annual spending power. The 78 million boomers born between 1946 and 1964 make up 28% of the U.S. population and own more than 77% of all financial assets. And the number of Americans aged 65 and older is set to double by the year 2030. This is an opportunity you can't afford to ignore." So another marketing plug. Ageism in media has many causes, but its cumulative effect has been to restrict and impoverish public dialogue about the increasing presence of older people in the 21st century. At this juncture, it remains unclear whether they will be viewed as mentors with time and experience to share, as selfish consumers to be exploited, or as healthcare dependents who will ultimately force the nations with the highest standards of living out of the competitive marketplace. And I'm going to get back to that. Looking back over the last 50 years in the U.S., one can see that Medicare and the community-based programs created by the Older Americans Act of 1965, and that's Meals on Wheels, adult daycare, and so on, can be viewed as responses to the cultural construction of old age as a concrete, temporally bounded category marked by frailty and dependence. Forced retirement and Social Security had already set the stage, making older people a more economically and socially predictable group. The federal strategy of limiting social welfare initiatives to problem groups, such as the elderly and the poor, had the unfortunate effect of confining even well-meaning public dialogue to negative issues, and, as Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward have long pointed out, to regulating discontent rather than addressing the underlying issues. So the underlying issues of poverty were never addressed. It was just, you know, provide a Band-Aid, and things will poke along for a little longer. Reviewing presentations of aging on television from a 1980s vantage point, Davis and Davis remarked that, quote, "The usual public affairs special about old people in the community is likely to focus on the visible elderly who have multiple health losses. Not surprisingly, polls conducted during the 1970s and 80s found people believing that a majority of elders were or inevitably would be confined to nursing homes, even though the actual number has held steady at about 5%. The U.S. identification of seniors as actually or potentially unwell led to a focus on old age as burdensome rather than to a reexamination of health policies for all citizens. It is interesting to compare the long-term effect on public opinion of targeting retirees as medically vulnerable, as has happened in the U.S., with views on health and aging in nations where universal subsidized health care is considered a basic need for citizens of all ages. For instance, during my lecture engagement in Denmark this past August, we took a tour of a senior adult day center and a nursing home. And at the nursing home, there was a lot of construction going on. And we asked, you know, what are they doing? And they said, well, we're reducing the population of this nursing home by half. And we asked more, and they said, well, the government has told us that the rooms have to be bigger for each person. So they were combining all the rooms in, you know, into one. Each two rooms was going to be combined into one room, and that institution would support half the people. And that was just considered a right. You know, there was no discussion about that. The government came around and said, hey, these rooms are too small. These people need bigger rooms. We asked about shared rooms, and they didn't know what we were talking about. Each person had his or her own thing. Some people had pets. So a whole different scene, a whole different set of expectations. And I say it's because universal health care is not stigmatized as being something for retirees, but it's for everybody. And so at a different stage, you have different needs. By the opening years of the 21st century, there was significant evidence that changing cultural values and baby boom demographics were shifting expectations about both social and physical aging. From the perspective of combating generalized ageism, This shift is, of course, beneficial. Yet supplanting attention to the real financial and health concerns of a generation with a superficial, healthy, wealthy image can lead to increased marginalization of elders who are unwell and poor, as can tipping the analytic balance between the agency of the individual to the extent that aging is presented as a choice that can be avoided. And this is something that I worry about. There's a lot of blame the victim with health problems and with aging too, that there are these other choices. Well, that's, you know, that has its limits, but not in the advertising world, and I think not in the policy world either. Boomers themselves have bought into this set of images. As the first generation to take television for granted, their realities have always been mediated. Exposure to closely targeted aspirational cluster marketing further accelerated the ongoing identity construction process of an aging population. And this concept of aspirational cluster is a very interesting thing. A British researcher named Dick Hebdige analyzed some things from MTV years ago using this. And it's the idea that things are marketed in clusters, so you can construct your identity, a little of this and a little of that, and then you're the individual. And it's an interesting idea. I think it is what happens. I have an interesting example of it backfiring here from a newspaper I picked up in Europe, but the story was covered here. And the title of this is Abercrombie Has Offer for Star, Shop Elsewhere. You know, Abercrombie and Fitch, the clothing manufacturer. And here's what it says. With their quick rise to fame, cast members of MTV reality show Jersey Shore have cashed in on a number of endorsement deals, including weight loss supplements, alcohol, and bronzer. But here's a twist. Teen apparel retailer Abercrombie & Fitch Company is offering to pay Michael the Situation Tarantino not to wear its merchandise. The New Albany, Ohio company released a statement titled, A Win-Win Situation, their little pun, in which it stated a, quote, deep concern over the association between Mr. Sorrentino and the brand. A&F offered up a substantial payment to Mr. Sorrentino to, quote, wear an alternative brand. And this is another quote from the company. We understand that the show is for entertainment purposes, but believe this association is contrary to the aspirational nature of our brand and may be distressing to many of our fans. The statement released late Tuesday read. So there's a, you know, a clothing company that's so worried about this guy. I've never even seen Jersey Shore because I don't know, I just have never seen it. But I know who he is, and some of you probably have seen this kind of tasteless character on this MTV program. As with MTV's efforts to commodify youthful identities, the marketplace thrived on what Hebdige has referred to as woofies, well-off older people. One of my favorite examples, bet dated now but still relevant, comes from a 2001 literature review by Bradley and Longino. They highlighted research suggesting that older people do not relate positively to product categories that reflect their chronological age. They raised the idea that simply increasing the representation of older people in advertising, older models, or even older role models, might not have the intended effect. They point instead to marketing strategies that urge advertisers to use models 10 to 15 years younger than the target audience, because some researchers suggested that many elders, especially those who are healthy and active, perceive themselves to be 75 to 80% of their actual chronological age. Bradley and Longino also identified several surveys that found older people actively dissatisfied with marketing efforts. In one study, almost one-third of respondents over age 55 reported boycotting products because of perceived age or youth stereotyping. If current retirees do not really conform to the stereotype that they are passive consumers of mass communication, it is reasonable to assume that aging boomers will display even more discontent in the information and entertainment marketplace. But at the same time, an aging population is being touted as a market opportunity in many quarters. The baby boom has begun to emerge also, again, as a threatening demographic group, and you can see that in these slides, in public discussions of aging. Beyond the obvious issues of cohort size and the resulting strain on healthcare and Social Security, new issues are beginning to register on the social agenda. Discussions of housing, employment, and consumer spending among aging boomers often emphasize the depletion of resources for younger groups, and you can see that in several of the cartoons, rather than the potential of healthy, well-educated retirees with discretionary incomes to make significant civic contributions. The question is an open one. Are baby boomers next in line to retire less likely to contribute time and expertise to civic causes than previous generations of volunteers? This question was sparked in some measure by Robert Putnam's provocative book, Bowling Alone, published in 2000. Any of you read that, Bowling Alone? Interesting book. Putnam and a team of researchers reviewed a lot of data and concluded that there has been a gradual but very marked trend away from participation in civic clubs, parent-teacher associations, and adult groups, and adult group activities such as bowling leagues or social engagement with neighbors and friends. Putnam, who teaches sociology at Harvard, gave the opening presentation at a 2002 conference where I was also invited to read a paper. The discussion following his remarks went something like this. The so-called Great Generation, honed by necessity during the Depression and World War II, shared a sense of community responsibility and an impulse towards civic engagement. Subsequent trends towards suburbanization, isolation of the nuclear family, and worker retirement mobility patterns eroded the belief that we are all in it together and replaced it with the 1980s era sense of, I got mine. It wasn't hard to find evidence for this trend, starting with the homeless in Harvard Square, just a couple of blocks from our conference site. Boomer interest in second careers, education, and self-actualization movements was already pretty much of a stereotype. In a curious twist, the marketplace seemed to be enabling the leading edge of the baby boom to resist imposed old age categories and instead continue a lifelong pattern of culturally sanctioned self-creation through individualized consumptions of goods, services, and experiences. There's a lot of interesting marketing about that. Fast forward to 2008. With the economic base that supported boomers no longer so secure, it was becoming clear that the established follow-the-money predictions made it easy to overlook more subtle but equally serious trends that might be undermining civic engagement among boomers. A couple of years ago, I attended a fascinating workshop at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg. The topic was news literacy, meaning how sophisticated people are at gathering news information and then evaluating the quality of what they find. Of particular interest when thinking about civic engagement was a presentation by a man from the Millennial Strategy Program, which is a market outfit. His name is Jack McKenzie. McKenzie spoke with his audience of journalists about three groups: baby boomers, 1946 to 64, Generation X, 1965 to 76, and the younger age set born between 1977 and, depending on who you talk to, either 1995, 1998, or the year 2000. And they're called millennials. You've probably heard that term. His focus was on generational change, and I found some of his findings quite surprising. He began with a discussion of shifting family relations, which was also a focus for Putnam in Bowling Alone. With regard to their early years, McKenzie characterized boomers as generally in conflict with their parents, Generation X as disengaged from their parents, and millennials as being in close contact with their parents and siblings. He credited Title IX, this is pretty interesting, a federal program which mandated equal access to sports for girls, with some of the shift toward family closeness. With both young girls and young boys involved in sports, he said, families began to spend a lot of time at practices and games, hence the soccer mom term. Not only were parents present, but siblings began to see each other as other engaged in sports and other activities. This fostered a sense of connection and camaraderie that helped to forge enduring family bonds and lines of communication. And I do see this in my new college students who are members of this generation. They're still in very close contact with their parents and their siblings. There's a common stereotype of young people locked in their rooms with the computer on, playing video games and online role-playing games such as Second Life or World of Warcraft. Yet McKenzie's research found millennials markedly more social than Generation Xers. One of my senior thesis students at New College did a study of men and women in their 20s who were deeply involved in online games. She found that despite the time they spent on computers, they maintained wide social networks that were often enhanced rather than diminished by their activities online. Much has been written about the media habits of boomers, who are more like their own parents than like any younger group when it comes to reading newspapers or watching television for news content. And the Pew Center for Research, if you want to look at some of this data, is really interesting, has really interesting studies. McKenzie supported the established finding that boomers maintain identifiable patterns when it comes to news gathering. They are habitual readers of newspapers, and they are more willing than younger people to schedule their time to accommodate traditional evening news broadcasts. In contrast, younger people are not tied to the news consumption patterns of their parents or grandparents, and they get news from a wide range of sources. Preference and personal are operative words in understanding these trends. Today's news consumers, especially younger ones, are impatient with general content sources that can't be reshaped to fit their interests. For years, studies have shown that young people are more interested in niche magazines than general circulation newspapers or magazines, and the aggregated news sources available on the internet have furthered this trend. So as you know, you can tailor what you see, the news you get, and younger people like that, rather, whereas older people are more likely to just go through the whole newspaper or Time magazine or something like that. That said, television remains dominant as a source of news for all groups. In a 2007 study for the Carnegie Knight Task Force on Journalism Education, respondents in a sample of 1,800 teens, young adults, and older adults reported their heaviest news exposure from television. The researcher found only 9% of teenagers reporting daily contact with print news pages. No real surprise there. But contrary to the popular assumption that the internet is the medium of choice for young news readers, it represented only 18% of first exposure to a major story for the younger age groups. So where are they learning about stuff? According to McKenzie of the Millennial Strategy Program, 46% of boomers seek out the news of the day, while only 29% of millennials do so. Instead, millennials let the news come to them. When asked to trace how they learned about a news event, millennials often cited a social network member as a source. A friend or my mom were common answers. Email, cell networks, and text messaging facilitate this style of information sharing. The same pattern has been found among very young adults when it comes to decision making about events. So where this is really going is that younger people are likely to hear about something from a trusted person, then consult multiple sources to check it out, and finally decide what they think based on varied information and contact with friends. If boomers are increasingly self-absorbed and locked in a one-way process of news consumption, in other words, watching TV or reading the paper, and Generation X is less concerned about the outside world than the boomers, millennials are very busy constructing social and information networks with both local and global reach. One problem, however, is that they lack news literacy, the term I mentioned before, which is the skill to distinguish factual information from biased reporting or outright lies. That's why it's pretty worrisome, some of the sources that young people are getting their news from. They've been tested a lot on this, and they have trouble telling because their historical depth is pretty weak. You know, what's true, what isn't? It's a worry. Why are these distinctions so important in understanding the ongoing cultural construction of aging and its mass-mediated representations? In the future, older people's currency as engaged citizens might be needed to provide a counterweight to the perception of elders as economic liabilities. In 2003, age trend analyst Ken Dickwald, and you may have heard of him, he wrote the book Age Wave, which was a popular book a few years ago, predicted that demography, quote, will shift the epicenter of consumer activity from an exclusive focus on youth to the needs, challenges, and aspiration of middle-aged or mature consumers. And that's what I've been talking about up to 2008. That prediction stands in sharp contrast to the comments from Dickwald, cited by leading U.S. AgeBeat reporter Paul Klayman in August 2011. So a few years later, he said this. This is from Klayman. Last April, I was surprised by comments made by one of the leading business consultants in the field of aging, Ken Dickwald, best known for his book Age Wave. Dick Wald had advised a long list of Fortune 500 CEOs on how to best position their products and services for the huge baby boomer market. He mentioned in an interview last fall that Standard & Poor's had published an alarming report that credit rated all the countries of the world based on their aging burden. It's a term. It is a sophisticated report, and all the people I know in investment and business read it and took it seriously. That was a quote from Dick Wald. Dick Wald also noted that reporters have posed more negative questions and comments about older people than he's heard in two decades. That's this past year. Dick Wald added, quote, basically the conclusion was, if you have a lot of old people, your country's going to go belly up. Standard & Poor's Global Aging 2010, An Irreversible Truth, and you can look that up on the internet, just Google that, is indeed an alarming report. The 47-page analysis of current and projected age-related spending by 49 nations predicts, quote, a general slide in sovereign credit ratings accelerated through 2030 and thereafter. The very first paragraph of the report, quoted here from the original and cited by Clayman, sets the tone. No, and this is a quote from the Standard & Poor's study, no other force is likely to shape the future of national economic health, public finances, and policymaking as the irreversible rate at which the world's population is aging. The problem has been long observed and is well understood. Standard & Poor's rating services believe that the cost of caring for these people will profoundly affect growth prospects and dominate public finance policy debates worldwide. Clayman points that at the report, including thinly veiled warnings to countries that they might find themselves, for example, less likely to retain investment grade ratings, lest they wrest control of their budgets in the agency's prescribed manner. And if you look at the report, there are charts of 30 plus countries, and they're predicting, you know, a real fall. Our credit rating has already been decreased by Standard & Poor's. And that wasn't brought up. It's interesting that this wasn't covered in the news as being one of the issues, but it is. Dick, well, someone usually upbeat about the corporate world and its potential for serving seniors and profiting from serving senior markets, Clayman says, observed, what I've seen in the past couple of years is a multiplication of serious-minded people talking about aging in very negative ways. I think that's because the economists have seized the subject. They're viewing older people not in terms of the qualities of contribution and wisdom, but seeing them as a burden on the government, and the stories are turning more and more dark. And this is still a quote. Looking at Standard & Poor's global economic outlook is what Dick Wald called the other side of the equation. More than seeing grandparents as threats to national bottom lines, he said, they need to ask honestly, what is it that older people give? What is their value? What is the wealth of nations? And I think that's a very important question. A key question for scholars concerned with the cultural construction of aging is whether boomers will truly break free of existing stereotypes, as many predict, or ultimately reinforce them. Answers will depend on the same infrastructural mix of social policy, economic reality, and public opinion that has generated popular stereotypes about today's elders. So this issue of engagement, you know, where people get their information, what they can do for society, is going to become, I think, increasingly important in the future. And I'd like to conclude by just running through the slides again. You might look at them a little differently now. Oh, oops. All right. You know, the engaged, right, political, and then self-indulgent, and now asleep at the wheel. Threats, you know, older people being a threat and a chain to children. Social Security. This one. Ambiguous message, but it's for sale for, I mean, what product could you use this as a picture for? Anybody? I don't know. That one? That one, which, see here, you have protesters and the protesters in France from last spring. And then old age crashes in. So that's my official comments. Does anybody have any questions or want to talk about anything? Happy to answer any questions or get a discussion going?
Yeah. Hi, Don DeMaio here. Pretty sad to think of the older population as an aging burden. Long time ago, when I was young, I was sent to Korea as an interpreter. And I found out there that all the young people referred to the older people, even strangers on the street, as uncle or aunt. Mm-hmm. And a term of endearment, a term of reverence that expresses their view that older people contained wisdom, a lifetime of experience, and deserved our respect, if nothing else. A lot of societies think that way. Unfortunately, ours is not one of them. Pretty depressing, I guess.
Well, I don't think it's depressing as much as it's important knowledge. I think that we take a little too much for granted, and it's important to know what policymakers are thinking, what the past is, what might happen, in order to counter it. There are many, many people, including most older people themselves, who don't feel that they're a burden, who feel they do have contributions to make. But as with any other group in a society such as ours that doesn't have policies that treat everybody equally, you have to fight for your rights. And I think we've entered a phase where baby boomers and retirees need to become really overtly active in their communities. Hmm. Yes?
How are the universities opening up to seniors for continuing education and interplay?
Well, University of South Florida has an open policy. I taught there, that was my first job when I got my doctorate back in the 1970s. And they have a policy in Tampa and in St. Petersburg, well, I know they do in St. Petersburg, where if there's room in the class, anybody over 65, I think, can sit on the class for free. And a lot of people do that. New College, that's open to members of the New College Foundation to do that. And we sometimes have people in our classes. In fact, in my urban anthropology class, there was a wonderful man who was a retired policymaker in New York who, you know, contributed a lot. So I think that's been in place for a while.
When you ask a question, let's use the mic so everyone can hear.
Hi. I just want to know if you have any statistics on the number of volunteer hours that are contributed by people who are not in the formal workforce.
I don't have those with me, but those statistics, two groups keep those pretty well. One is AARP, and another is the Points of Light Foundation. The talk that I mentioned that I gave at Harvard, where Putnam was there, one of the other presenters was from Points of Light Foundation, which was established by Reagan as a kind of a George Bush the first, I'm not sure. Yeah, as a conservative kind of way to get away from public engagement and taking money. But it's actually grown to be a very interesting organization. They have a lot of statistics. And they do show that older groups, they show one really two interesting things, both of them. One is that people who volunteer when they're young volunteer when they're older. That there are not too many people who suddenly, you know, get with the program when they retire. That if you look at the histories of volunteers who are retired, they were the same people who went to the PTA, who drove in the carpools, who coached the soccer team or the baseball teams, you know, when they were young people. That's one thing. So that's why it's really important, I think, to instill volunteering in all age groups. One thing we're real proud of our students, they do a lot of volunteer work, a lot of community activist work, which has kind of gotten a bad name in recent years. I think it's real important. The other thing that was found was that people volunteer because somebody asked them to. And, you know, they say there are more volunteers that come out of church groups. Well, they looked into that more closely. Is it because of a religious motivation or because it's a group of people who see each other and ask each other to do things? And it's really more the latter, that when you, and it goes across groups, when you get asked by somebody else, you're like, you don't just spontaneously go out there and do things. So I think those are important, but I don't have those figures, but they're easy to find.
Well, you mentioned that there was 5% of people at some point that were going into nursing mm-hmm. homes or assisted living facilities. Is that still the case, or is there anything like for presently, what's going on at the present moment, or what's projected for the next 20 years? Although I don't know how you can project something like that.
Yeah, it's hard to project. Nursing homes and assisted living facilities are not a joint category. I mean, just nursing homes, you know, full care facilities, it's about the same. I think it's projected to increase slightly only because the number of people in the age of 85 and older, where you tend to get more people in that category, is going to increase. But it's actually so much tinier than, it's like any statistic or health statistic. You hear a lot about something and you kind of globalize it. It's like, you know, dementia is not that common, but it's all anybody can think about. So it's a small percentage.
Hello. Here. Do you, in comparing the spending per capita of youth versus the older people typically mm-hmm. spend it on pharmaceuticals, but travel and second homes, and young people are much more trendy. How do those two figures compare? Because that would give us some indication of who contributes financially, more than just volunteering and work hours, but financially to society.
Well, if you look at Social Security, for example, people are talking a lot about the problems with it and so on. What they're not looking at is the reason it was originally instituted and what it still does today, which is recirculates money in the local economy. Social Security dollars are spent. I mean, that seems like kind of obvious, but it's an often overlooked fact that people aren't hoarding their Social Security money, they're spending it. And so the circulation of money, and during the Depression, there were several proposals. One was called the Townsend Act, where they were trying to give each older person an income floor. But the deal was they had to spend it all every month. And that's essentially what happened under another name. So I think if you look at the circulation of money, it's more important than, you know, the amount of money, although the generations are real significant. The mid group, the baby boomer group, has the most money because of the time that they, you know, of their work life. It's a time of relative prosperity. And the younger people are projected to have much less in terms of resources, both capital resources and discretionary money. So, you know, I don't know exact figures except that the baby boomers are the biggest spenders.
Hi. that 5% figure, I did want to talk to you about that. The is interesting because, you know, we've been approached by a number of insurance salesmen. They have a different figure. we were told that there's a 60% chance or something that we're going to end up in a nursing home. I don't know where that number comes from, but...
Well, that comes from insurance salesmen. you know, you can do all sorts of things with statistics. But really, I mean, nursing homes are an industry. You know, that's another thing that is tied to Social Security. Before Social Security, there were no nursing homes. There were retirement homes. There were poor houses. My hometown had a poor house, and a lot of the people in there were elderly. But it was only when people began to have a guaranteed income that an industry developed to exploit that.
Take the income away from them.
Yeah.
Who's next? Yeah, excuse me. I have a couple of comments. You mentioned being in Denmark this past summer, mm-hmm. and I have a little bit of knowledge of through the family. And have seen the way people are treated over there, as well as in other Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
And one of the nicest places was in Finland, where we don't think much about the Finns as being part of that Scandinavian mm-hmm. group, but they have lovely programs. But one of the questions I have for you, we're also talking about volunteerism. And there is an opposite effect. the countries that have the best programs often are not countries where people volunteer. And a lot of Europeans look at us and are amazed that we spend so much time volunteering. And I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Sure, sure. Effect. I guess my first response would be they volunteer with their money. Because, you know, when we were talking about, we were talking to one of the professors, a young professor who took us around the city to look at some things, and he said, you know, that his parents pay 65% of their income in taxes. And, you know, he went to college for free, but he said that his, the expectation of young people is that when you turn 18, and you get this, you not only get your free tuition, but you get a stipend from the government while you're a student, that you're expected to move out of the house and, you know, set up your own place and make something of yourself. So it's a different model, but I think the financial contribution is really big. And the places that we visited, well, the people there were paid staff. They were doing jobs that others would volunteer for in the U.S., especially at the Adult Day Center. I did a lot of research at one in St. Pete, and it had a paid staff, but the real work was done by volunteers. The one we visited in Copenhagen had paid staff, but it was a fantastic place. They had a crafts room where people were making leather purses. The men were involved in all this leather work, and they had kilns and pottery and so on, and they had actual professional craftspeople running these things, and it was just a different model. So,
anything else? Oh, one question over there.
Something positive in Sarasota County. Mm-hmm. High school students are currently required to give a certain amount of hours every year to volunteer work, and. I think it's very positive,
yeah.
But I would like to say that that the list of places they can volunteer could be expanded. There are many areas where they are not being asked to volunteer, but they are available,
mm-hmm.
And it is required for their school, promotion. So
right.
I think that. Personally, I think that should be all over the country. I don't think it is.
Well, from what I've seen, you know, it's modeling that behavior in young people that will stay with them throughout life. And I don't think we're going to go to the 65% tax contribution anytime soon. So I think that the importance of civic engagement, of being involved in your community, is just critically important. And I have other talks about other subjects related to aging. And one thing that concerns me is the trend toward isolation of older people. There's a lot of the marketing that's gone on, and you see the signs around here, the billboards for retirement communities that suggest to people that you're successfully aging if you're in an age-segregated community. I know a lot of people live in those, and that's fine, but for that to be the aspiration, again, what you aspire to model for everybody, is a problem. It's a problem. It's a problem in media because if you ever look at the Huffington Post, anybody look at that? All right, they have a new thing called Post 50, which is a site for people 50 and older, news site, just started. And it's age segregation. It's a step above when they had segregated women's pages and, quote, colored pages in newspapers. It's taking the news about aging and out of the mainstream where younger people could look at it and learn from it and putting it in a special category, and I don't think that's a good trend at all.
Is there any difference in aging patterns, advertisers, et cetera, between male and female?
Sure. More health products are advertised to women. Part of that is there are just more older women than older men. There's an interesting change in terms of beauty products, though, because more men use hair dye, more men have facelifts than I would have ever thought possible in the past. And so there is more image marketing to men than there used to be, but women are still the targets, and women are considered to be the main household purchasers across age groups, except maybe for the millennials. The very young people, you have a more equal distribution of men and women in terms of who's buying things. But for older generations, it's more likely the woman who does the buying and makes the major purchase decisions for the household and so on, except for cars, which are still marketed to men. Yeah.
I just want to mention that here in Sarasota at the Pines Nursing Home, there's a program in place called the Eden Project.
Eden Alternative?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, where children are in daycare there, and they interact with the senior community, very healthy, and they have pets on site as well.
Yeah, yeah. That's a movement. It's nationwide. I think I'm a big advocate of pets in nursing homes. Yes.
I wonder if you'd comment on the possible distinction between, the boomer 60s experience, where there was a sharp sort of contrast between the young and the old. The 60s political involvement, it was very much a youth movement driven by music and all kinds of generational differences. Mm-hmm. And now Occupy Wall Street, which the early signals from that seem to be somewhat different. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts.
Well, the studies, and I cited them a little bit, show that the boomer generation is somewhat estranged from their parents' generation. And some of that had to do with the 60s protests and reactions to things. Whereas the millennials, who are the people doing this occupying of Wall Street, they're young, they're college students, they're young people, are intergenerationally engaged and much better informed than the middle generation, which would be their parents, Generation X, which across all studies seem to be somewhat apathetic or withdrawn or something as a group. I mean, certainly there are individuals that stick out, but they've not made a mark for themselves politically the way the boomers did or the way the millennials seem to be doing. It's interesting.
Hi. Well, nobody else has a question, I'll ask. You mentioned that the boomers, I guess is your title, got their news mostly from general interest sources like daily newspapers, Time magazine, but that the younger people are more selective about. What do you think the upshot of that is? I mean, where is that going? What does that tell us about the future?
Well, I'm a trustee of the Poynter Institute, and we do a lot of talking about that in relation to the future of newspapers, and nobody knows the answer right now. It has become clear that the older platform of the general information newspaper, something for everybody or nothing for anybody, but still it comes to the house and you look through it and maybe all you look at is the comics or the TV page or maybe you like international news. That is, and this is trend has been shown for decades, to be markedly generationally identified. And the history of that is pretty interesting. Readership studies indicate, and there's pretty good agreement on this, that for people who were alive during and reading newspapers or able to read during World War II, they developed the habit of following troop movements in the newspaper and looking at the newspaper and looking at where things were because that's what their parents were doing. And that modeled a pattern of looking to the newspaper for information that's become lifelong. And that was kind of continuing. Younger people in the past didn't read the newspaper as much as their parents, but then the studies would show you reach a certain age, you know, you get married, you have a family, you want to look at the what's at the cafeteria for the kids or whatever, you start to read the newspaper. That trend has now stopped. So there's a real marked distinction. Young people, and I think some of the figures I cited were a couple of years old, so it's become more so. I mean, that Twitter, looking at sites, and there are a lot of these aggregation sites They've adopted the term curating, you know, curate the news. So there are people whose job is to just take news from different sources and put it together in a package that a certain group would like, and you sign up for your preferences. You see that on the, you know, on the internet all the time, preferences, and you get certain news feeds, and everything else drops off. It's kind of the difference between if you go to a library with OpenStax, you know, you go in, you look around, you might not find the book you're looking for, but you find 10 other interesting books, right? As opposed to a closed stacks library where you have to know what you're looking for, and you just ask for that book, and you never get to see the other books. I think that's something like what's going on.
Yet, I know in our family, mm-hmm. our kids never read newspapers or magazines, but today they're almost addicted to the internet and the,
right.
the news sources. So they're reading a lot more. It's just very selective.
Yeah, it's selective. And you know, the disturbing thing that I mentioned is the studies are showing that their literacy about what they're reading is not what it used to be. They don't have the context. I mean, there have been some really big studies of this, administering tests to different age groups, and you know, what is your historical depth in terms of understanding a news story? And one sort of interesting thing they found was if you compare, say, people who were teenagers during the Vietnam era with teenagers today, those people understood a lot more of things about the Vietnam War than kids today understand about wars or whatever the country's involved in. I mean, they both have equally strong opinions about it, but what are those opinions based on? Where do they go, you know, to verify? And I didn't talk about another thing that was brought up, which is that a lot of young people get their opinions from media, like entertainment media, like, you know, actors they admire or songs they admire, you know, become part of their political opinion in ways that I think started during the 60s but has really accelerated.
A lot of young people say their sole source of news is the Jon Stewart Show.
Right. And, you know, that's actually been seriously looked at as an alternative model. You know, can this be done? Can news be made entertaining and still retain its news value? I think I like the Jon Stewart Show, but I think for somebody to say this is their only source of news is it's a problem.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, thank you very much,
Professor.
All right,
thank you.